podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. Bowled out for 36 at Adelaide without Kohli, Ashwin, Bumrah, Jadeja, Ishan, Umesh and Shami. India chased 328 on the final day at Brisbane to seal a barely believable series-clinching win against all odds. We'll be talking about that test, England's win at Gaul and more. I'm Yaz Rana and with me today is the Editor-in-Chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker, the Magazine Editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon, and Cricviz Analyst, Ben Jones. Ben, we'll start with you as you've been pretty much nocturnal for the last 6 weeks. For those who haven't got around to watching the highlights yet or couldn't watch it live, sum up for us what happened on that remarkable final day.
Well, it was remarkable. It was one of those days of Test cricket which we do have, like, periodically you go into a last day thinking, oh, they need 300 odd to get the win and the opposition need 10 wickets or maybe they need fewer and you're thinking, this is going to play out fairly predictably. Yeah, there's 90 odd overs to go. We're going to get a result here. There was a bit of weather around in Brisbane, so we were kind of thinking maybe we're going to lose a few overs, maybe the draw is going to come in. But just the nature of the fact that India are always going to want to go for the win made things quite exciting, and Australia obviously needed to in order to kind of, yeah, take the series. But things started out really beautifully. As Phil mentioned on the last podcast, Rohit Sharma kind of got in, looked quite nice, looked good for a little bit of time, and then got out. And then Shubman Gill and Pujara kind of started doing their thing. And for a session this morning, it looked like India were going to not just do it, but kind of do it in the way that you'd want to in an ideal scenario, with one guy kind of blocking it out in Pujara and Gill just showing all this class and all this amazing ability that he's got, kind of throwing the bat and everything really aggressively and playing this kind of Sehwag style innings. And then there was a particular shot which I thought kind of really brought to mind Sehwag, was this kind of uppercut from a really wide ball off Stark, which went for six down to third man. And there was a really good crowd catch, which I think always kind of elevates a six. And it was just, at that point, you're thinking, this is going one way. India are going to get on top and the required run rate's falling. A couple of wickets fall and things start to get a bit twitchy. Ajinkya Rahane comes out and plays a really aggressive kind of 20 odds to try and get the required run rate down. And things just start to drift away from India a little bit and you think this is going to kind of go towards a block out. But then Rishabh Pant comes out and all of the talk across the whole day has been about the idea that Pant is this kind of ace up the sleeve of India, that this kind of wild card who can... basically, in the minds of the commentators and the kind of punditariat, like, score eight and over, nine and over. But realistically, like, even just scoring a run of ball was going to be quite a useful thing. And he comes out and he blocks for a bit. He gets 20 off 40, 30 off 60. And then he starts to accelerate and wickets start to fall around him. Pujara goes. Second new ball takes all of that effect. Takes a few wickets. Agarwal comes in and goes. And then with about 60 off 60 needed at the end of the day, Pant and Washington Sundar, this 21-year-old and 23-year-old, just decide that, yeah, you know what, this Test cricket luck, you know, we play IPL, we play proper cricket, we're just going to start hitting sixes and ramps and little reverse sweeps, little dabs around the corner, and all of a sudden they're in about 10 off 30, and if anything, the day ends in a bit of an anticlimax because India walk it. This wasn't Headingley, this wasn't nine down needing, you know, one off one ball. It was actually, in the end, pretty comfortable, which is insane because this is the sixth highest ever chase against Australia and it didn't really seem hard, which is pretty mad.
It's crazy to think that a few weeks ago, India didn't pick Rishabh Pant in their 11 and now he's hit back-to-back fourth innings classics. Phil, I remember we were talking, I don't know, I can't remember, it might have been during the IPL after he had quite a difficult IPL, and you said that Pant will eventually be remembered for what he does in Test cricket. How impressed have you been about how he's bounced back from a difficult few months, from not even making the 11 to, you know, leading one of India's great away wins, great wins full stop?
Yeah, I remember saying that as well. And I think on reflection, I probably said it because I don't pay that much attention to all the other stuff in reality. But in the end, your legacy is still just about carved out in the long form of the game. And a player with those kinds of components deserves that stage. Now, Rishabh Pant can go out there and smash, you know, an ODI 160 balls in Cuttack or wherever, and we will applaud it and forget about it by the following morning. And that obviously applies with a little bit more oomph when it comes to all 20 over cricket. But when you go out there and do that, back to back, different kinds of innings as well. The 97 was a dashing innings. May have come off, may have not. It was appointed innings as well because, you know, infamously he wasn't playing in that first test match. And he came off the back of, correct me if I'm wrong, but a pretty indifferent IPL where his approach was being questioned for the first time. And so to come out there in the previous test match and take the piss for 90-odd was one thing. But then to come out and strum an unbeaten and untouchable and completely in control 80-odd today and look like a seasoned, gnarled pro in there at the peak of his powers. You know, I call him Matryoshka Doll Stokes, really. Completely in control of his game. Completely in control of the scenario that was presented to him. And to see that play out, it was quite rousing from an Indian perspective. It was rousing from a neutral's perspective. But again, we always come back to it. And it's this ongoing hand-wringing paranoia that we have about the hoary old five-day game. Well, what it told us again is it's the best goddamn game ever created. And that will resonate throughout the cricketing world. Just as an aside, Harry Kane tweeted, I just saw half hour ago, get him on the show, yes. Get him on the show. Yeah, it was glorious. I'm feeling slightly ragged because I made the mistake of watching most of it. I know you know, hit young kids, you know, you don't mind it. But for me, I'm struggling a little bit. But yeah, it was deeply stirring stuff.
What did Harry Kane have to say, Phil, about the Australia-India test?
Every test has been really exciting. Great win for at BCCI. He knows what side his bread's buttered.
Awesome. Yeah, when he says every test, does that mean he was watching South Africa, Sri Lanka as well recently? He's really got into his test cricket.
Every test of the modern era. I don't think that. More this humdinger down under. But we'll have to find out when he's on the show next week.
We'll get him on next week to see if he thinks England should play two or three spinners in the first test. Gurav asks, after a couple of years, people look at the series and look at the numbers in the series and note that Pujara averaged only 33 while Pant averaged 68 for the series. Is one possible without the other? We'll go to you, Ben.
No, it's not. That's the whole point of Test cricket, isn't it? That we get bound up in this kind of little cricketing culture war between our, you know, T20 cricket versus Test cricket, 5-day versus ODI, whatever. The point is that cricket changes across formats, but the kind of fundamental principles are the same. You need people to do jobs and you need people to do other jobs. Everything complements each other. Pujara knackered the Australian bowlers across an entire series. That's 900 plus deliveries. That doesn't happen very often in Australia. The way that he did that was by blocking and blocking and blocking and leaving and blocking. He did it for the best part of 2 months. Australia didn't rotate their attack. They picked the same attack for 4 tests in a row. Cameron Green had a really bad series with the ball. I know he's a young kid, but you have to go back to 1993 or 1996, I think, when Casper Rich was early on in his career, for an Australian bowler to bowl as often and not take a wicket. So they had basically had a 4-man attack for the whole series. So Pujara grinding these guys down and just taking overs out of their legs and just really wearying them meant that when Pant does come in, he can play his shots and he can use all those IPL skills, all of that ability. And it means that actually, yeah, as you say, like we look at Pujara in 2018-19 and you think, yeah, he averaged what 60 plus and he was a legitimate great then. That was a properly brilliant series, made that incredible double ton, I think, or double ton at either Sydney or Melbourne and another ton in the other place. And so you had that obvious kind of scorecard greatness. But this time he kind of had a greater emphasis on him because there was no Kohli there. He had to do more. He didn't do more by making more runs, but he did more by just kind of soaking up more. He just kind of took all the punches for the whole batting order and said, right, you know, I'm the old wizened pro. I'll take it. I'll take the hits. I'll have Cummins coming at me. And I mean, he got hit, I think it was 14 times this series. It was the most we've ever recorded by an Indian batsman in a series, which is since 2006. I think it might be by any batsman since 2006 in Australia. So he's taking unprecedented levels of blows. But Pant is then coming out and genuinely being brilliant. I don't want to detract from him by saying Pujara is doing all the greatness for him. I think Pant's now got the second highest average in the 4 things of Test cricket ever, which, you know, it's a tiny sample, tiny portion of the game, but it's the portion of the game when it's supposed to be really hard. And I think that part of the reason that he's doing really well
in that phase is because he's a brilliant player and he's a legitimately kind of elite batsman in the next 5 years or so. But it's also because Pujara has done a hell of a lot of work in the preceding overs, just really soaking up the pressure, knackering those bowlers. And you know, when Lyon's bowling like a drain, Stark's really not bowling very well. They just keep going back to Cummins and they just keep going back to Hazelwood. And all of a sudden they've bowled 30 overs in a day and a half. It's pretty, suddenly Pant can come in and just express himself in that kind of cliche way. I think the partnership between them, it has been some genuinely really lovely about this thing in terms of like giving Test cricket a shot in the arm, as the cliche is. It's like, that is the point of it, is that there is room for everyone. It's like rugby union having room for like the kind of 5'1" winger. Like the point of it is that you've got this scope of skill. That's what makes it a great sport. Yeah, I'm still giddy about how well Pant did, but that's more from a kind of personal vindication point of view. But I think what Pujara did this series will endure in a way that maybe right now, as you say, an average of 30 or it doesn't necessarily suggest it might.
I guess the obvious point to make is that these fourth innings totals that certainly 10, 15 years ago and certainly further back from that just would have been inconceivable and teams would have shut up shop straight away. They are now becoming quite tasty and conceivable options. And what we saw today was a team that didn't necessarily have to win to retain this trophy and all of that. Coming into that final day, looking at the scorecard, seeing 300, and yeah, this is a day 5 pitch. All right, it's Australia, so it holds together reasonably well, but it was still turning appreciably at times and it still had a lot of pace and bounce in it. Looking at that total, I'm thinking, yeah, we can take that. We'll take that down and we'll do it properly. And it was interesting the way that the TV reflected the change of tone, really. And so it turned from kind of 110 needed from maybe 22 overs, but very soon it was 68 needed from 73 balls. And then it just became this run chase that became very familiar for people. And so it was this marvellous combination of fearlessness on the one hand and seeing these kids who don't really understand failure, and they're all already multimillionaires, and they've already been told from the age of about 7 that you are going to be great, you are going to be iconic. And it's very much another day for them, and it's another day at work. And so we can stand back and be staggered by these numbers that are now routinely getting knocked off in fourth innings chases. But it is a beautiful consequence of this you know, pyjama stuff that we all know and love. And if we can continue to have that infusion, then the game is looking very rosy for the future. It was a brilliant line. Kerry O'Keefe, what a commentator, by the way. Kerry O'Keefe, what a brilliant commentator. He said, detached from consequence was his description of the end. And it's this kind of new businessy kind of term, but I thought it summed up the approach of Sundar in particular when he comes out here on his debut test match and strums a 25 to again just get the thing over the line. And it's that notion, isn't it? And you hear it a lot from players when you interview them. Don't think about the outcome. Don't think about tomorrow. Don't think about any criticism. Don't think about derision. Don't think about what the coach is saying in your ear. Just go out and do what you do. And cricket has wrestled with that notion for centuries. And it seems now, as a consequence of all of the fun stuff that is cricketainment and more, it's now flooding into the test game. And the test game, whisper it, certainly in my lifetime, has never been more exciting than it is right here and now.
Joe, and one thing that Phil touched on that I think is quite interesting is that these bigger chases are becoming not just happening more frequently, but they're becoming harder for the fielding teams to defend. Batsmen now, even quite low down the order, have a range of shots that didn't really exist 10, 15 years ago. And once teams get within that 100-run zone, when they have a sniff of chasing the higher targets, I think, you know, in the most famous high-profile big run chase in the last few years, I think fielding captains have found it quite hard to counteract that. Do you think that's fair? And do you think we're going to see more 300-plus fourth innings chases than we might have done in previous years?
I think that's absolutely the case. Things are possible that weren't even possible to dream of only a few years ago. And it means it's easy to drift into hyperbole when the events are so fresh. But I think this has to be the best away series win in my lifetime. I was thinking of a few earlier that popped into my head. Australia winning in the Caribbean in 1995. South Africa winning in Australia in 2008, 2009, when Australia just did not lose on home soil. And then from an English-centric point of view, you naturally think of the 10-11 Ashes or winning in India. But that 10-11 Ashes win, for instance, that Aussie bowling attack was considerably weaker than what India have faced up to over the last few weeks. That Australia team didn't really have a spinner worthy of the name. The quicks were very hit and miss. Then when you throw in all the things that were thrown at this India side, the manner of that first test defeat, the ridiculous injury list, Australia's attack, which we were talking about as being the greatest Australian attack of all time at the start of the test series, the absence of Kohli, who's their captain, their best batsman, and basically the whole heartbeat of the team as we understood it, but perhaps not quite as much as we thought, because Rahane has completely taken on that role. And I thought how cool Rahane looked at the end when they'd pulled off that chase. He just kind of puffed out his cheeks a little bit and strolled onto the pitch. He has become an absolute giant of a man over the last few weeks. And he's obviously, the way he plays, the way he acts, he does kind of operate in the background a little bit, and perhaps necessarily so when Kohli is there. But it's been great to see him become this force for Indian cricket in a way that I didn't necessarily think he was capable of. And they've got some interesting selection decisions ahead of them, haven't they? Because you get used to seeing the same Indian test team pretty much all conditions, pretty much wherever they play, because they've got such a strong side. And what's really become apparent, not that we didn't know it, but perhaps we didn't know to what extent, is just the depth of Indian cricket is just astonishing. To come in the way that some of these players have over the last couple of weeks and not only do their bit, but to grab games by the scruff of the neck and actually win them for their side is something pretty extraordinary. And that's why I think, even if I don't think I'd be interested, I mean, Phil's been around a bit longer than the rest of us. Phil, any away series wins to kind of rival that in your time watching cricket?
Top of my head, I can't think of any particularly. You mentioned the South Africa one, 08-09, I think it was. That was a bit of a kind of game-changing winter, really. Not just because Australia were knocked off their perch for the first time in a generation, but because of the nature of how they went about it. You're talking about big fourth innings chases. They chased down 400 at Perth, and de Villiers made an unbeaten 100, and it was a cruise. And I remember watching that. And again, you just didn't see that happening. Before that, the West Indies chased 400 at Antigua, but that's a postage stamp ground, and it was a one-off. That series against South Africa looked like it was... the tone of the game was changing a little bit because that the modernity of one-day cricket was beginning to flood into Test cricket. But yeah, overall, your point, Joe, can't think of anything more dramatic than this. And just on Rahane, firstly, touch of the Noel Gallagher's, I thought, at the end today, just the way he sort of strides around, you know, king of the castle, but ostentatiously unemotional, wasn't he, at the end? Like Dhoni style. Inside, he's obviously going, this is unbelievable. But he had to maintain his composure. I liked it. I liked it very much. The 100 at Melbourne will go down in legend. We'll have to. And the folly of predictions, just if I dare, I did have a look at Wisden Cricket Monthly from 2 months ago this morning, Joe. Your one, 3-1 Australia. The only way India can stay in the series if they're one up going into the second test, because with Kohli going home, Rahane doesn't stand a chance. And Adam Collins, bless him, the great Adam Collins, your friend and mine, 4-0 Australia, 4-0. There's going to be a reset.
Well, you know what, Phil? I thought you might bring this up.
Yeah, I thought you show. Might.
And precedent has been set. We're going to be starting to trawl through some predictions from now on.
I feel like this is a very dangerous game and one I don't really want us to play.
You remember, Joe, I said it was going to be very close. Do you remember that? I did say that.
But anyway. And I think you predicted exactly how it would unfold as well, didn't you, Phil?
I did, to the letter, yeah.
He actually predicted the exact birthday of Kohli's child as well. That was what was quite creepy about it. Just to jump in on Rahane's innings at Melbourne as well, because obviously that was primarily framed as being the kind of comeback, the response to Adelaide. It was the response to 36 all out. It was the response to Kohli going home. It was, I'm the Indian captain now. I'm the big man. This is my time. But actually, there's not been any other Indian centuries in the tour, and yet they've won 2-1. And I think that kind of flips it. If we do think about those kind of great modern wins of teams going to Australia and winning, you compare it to 10-11, like every England batsman who was worth his salt, you know, down to about the 10th ranked batsman in the country, went and got a ton on that tour. Like, that was a batting tour. That was how they won that. I mean, Stuart Broad always brings it up when he's asked about how to win in Australia. It's like, you win by batting, you don't win by bowling. And everyone made a century. This series, India rocked up and they won with their bowling. And it was their bowling that was decimated by injury. It was the bowling that was down to their ninth choice seamer. Shardul Thakur, as much as, you know, he's a very exciting bowler and he bowled incredibly well, but he's not anywhere near as good as India's first choice attack. And yet he was the one that was as responsible for victory here as anyone else. Yeah, the fact that there was this sort of pronounced absence of centuries is, you know, it's slightly bizarre really when you think of how other teams have gone to Australia and just said, like, okay, well, we're gonna first draw and then we're gonna win. We're gonna work from that way backward. Whereas actually India have just rocked up with a brilliant seam attack and then a brilliant second string seam attack, and then basically a brilliant third string seam attack, and bowled Australia out twice at the Gabba and then chased it down. It's, yeah, I think that's what will, again, in the fullness of time, we'll look back on this and be like, wow, India won two tests in Australia with one individual century. And it's like, yeah, a couple of 90s, but it's, yeah, statistics and all that. You can't trust them.
A few weeks ago on the show, we talked about, we picked our imaginary England fifth test of next Ashes teams. And India's team for the fourth test of this series was very England at the end of the Ashes series, but they ended up winning it. You know, one thing I'm quite interested in about how this India 11 will be remembered at the end of their careers. So Rahane, Pujara, we know how they will be remembered by and large. But the rest are all reasonably inexperienced at test level. And I wonder if we'll look back and think, sure, they were inexperienced at the time, but most went on to do great things. We'll look back and see a few guys who barely ever played again. I mean, the bowling attack, Washington, Shardul, Siraj, Saini and Natarajan had only bowled 10 deliveries between them in test cricket before this test. That was Shardul bowled 10 deliveries on test debut 2 years ago before pulling up injured. Bill Peppers has got quite a good question. He says, is this the start of a period of sustained dominance for India, given demographics, affluence, and maybe most importantly, the discovery of quicker bowlers able to perform in alien overseas conditions?
2 years ago, I think it was, maybe 2.5 years ago now, they went to South Africa and lost. They lost 2-1. And yet, I wrote about it at the time for the magazine, and I said, this has been India's month. And it was because of what happened at Joburg. Do you remember that game at Joburg on a green mamba of a pitch? And Elgar made an 80-odd and was hit from head to toe and somehow managed to survive it to win the game. Rahane made a 48, I think it was, an incredible back-to-the-wall kind of innings. They won that game, and lost the series, but won that game, and they beat South Africa on their own patch at their own game. And Bumrah was still an emerging name. Shami obviously is a, you know, a pedigree bowler, but there wasn't a body of evidence to show that this is what Indian cricket has become and this is what Indian cricket will become. But by the end of that game, I was pretty convinced that if they can sew up that kind of performance away from home in foreign climes, adjusting their embarrassments of riches to suit the occasion and the conditions, then no one's ever going to stop them. No one's ever going to stop them. The one caveat I would add is that you can only play 11v11. So, and, you know, great players emerge by osmosis almost. You know, Ben Stokes is not the result of our evolved approach to state school cricket, right? So genius comes from the nooks and crannies of sport in life, sure. But the depth of Indian cricket has always been terrifying to look from the outside, and you've seen its kind of graduation in the last few days, really. As you say, those numbers are joke numbers. The inexperience of that bowling attack, that is ridiculous, really. And when you think about the team that they're coming up against at the Gabba, where they last lost in 1988,
yeah, yeah. My parents had just started uni.
There you go. All right. Okay. Yeah, so yeah, staggering, really. It's very hard to see them ever being not in the top two. But there's the beauty of sport, that it is still cyclical. And also, whisper it, they haven't won an ICC tournament in ages, which is a bizarre and increasingly peculiar fact, isn't it? When you see how invariably dominant they are in Test cricket.
Well, this is what I was going to say. I mean, they haven't won a T20 World Cup since the first one, which they didn't take seriously and sort of won almost by chance. So they haven't won it since they've had the IPL. They haven't actually had the success that you would expect. So, and I think it's we're talking a kind of a side dominating in the way that Australia did in West Indies before them. I think it's so much harder to do that now with three formats, the schedule as it is, the demands on players, teams having to rotate more often. Australia just played the same test team for about 7 years. I mean, and everyone knew exactly their role, and teams just can't do that now. So I think in a way, we love these great teams that come along and you can compare them from previous series, but I think it's actually better for the game when you have, as we do at the moment, four or five teams, probably four teams competing for top spot who can beat each other.
I'd also say that like we often have these conversations when a team does well with seemingly great depth, as we all kind of get very excited / stressed about the idea that, you know, this is kind of going to be an unending dynasty until the end of time, and how are we going to ever stop this? And it's like, you know, will Pep Guardiola's Barcelona ever lose a game ever again? Well, yeah, guess what? When everyone gets old and you have to bring the next generation in, things get harder. And as much as we see Shubman Gill being brilliant now, part of what's been so exciting about this series, I think, is that the guys that have come in have performed above their expectations. They've not performed because they're predicted to be absolute worldie. They're predicted to be good, and then they've been amazing. No one thought Washington Sundar is going to take the best figures at the Gabba by an Indian spinner in ages. Like, Washington Sundar is not a first-class bowler. He's a good bowler. He's a brilliant T20 bowler. But he's rocked up and he's done way more than we thought he was going to. And maybe that's, you know, because he's got some kind of moxie, he's got some kind of extra element, which means that he's going to perform like that forever. But it could also be that, you know, the spirit and the occasion has kind of filled him up, and he's, you know, they've performed over and above their expectations, and that's as good as it's ever going to be. Personally, I think India have got, obviously they've got, you know, a billion people to draw on and a cricketing culture to be envious of, but at the same time, Australia have had this kind of, this sense of, oh, you know, well, they've got all these players now. This is it. This is it forever now. They won 5-0 in the Ashes. They won 4-0 in the Ashes. They can't ever lose again. And then they do, because eras fade away and things get hard. If Kohli and Pujara and Rahane aren't replaced, because how the hell are you going to replace those guys? They're geniuses. You can replace them with Shubman Gill, but you need another two Shubman Gills. I think we can see in the next 5-10 years, India be great, but whether they're going to be 80s Windies, 90s Australia great, if they are, then that's testament to them. It's not testament to some kind of structural thing which is entirely biased in their favour. You've kind of got to give them the credit if they do execute it. But yeah, it is a bit scary.
It was only a few weeks ago that Australia were top of the rankings, looked set for a spot in the World Test Championship final, which they still have a decent chance of qualifying for. And now there are quite a few question marks over a few members of their team. Harris averages under 25 in Test cricket, Wade about 30, Tim Payne we've talked about quite a lot this series. Joe, do you see them making any wholesale changes ahead of their Test series in South Africa that should start next month, which is the only Test series, by the way, that they've got scheduled before the Ashes, with the exception of the possible World Test Championship final and a one-off test against Afghanistan in November?
Well, Tim Payne's got to be under some serious pressure, I'd have thought. Australian captains don't lose too many Test series at home and get away with it. And he's also not such a strong batsman and keeper that he necessarily warrants a place for those disciplines. So I don't know what the kind of press are saying in Australia at the moment. I haven't looked at that this morning, but I'd have thought he's got to be under some pretty serious pressure. Perhaps not getting the boot quite yet, but he's probably one bad series away from relinquishing that. And we talked about last week who takes over. I mean, I think Cummins would be a great shout, but that's by no means a given. So that would be a huge decision for them to have to make. And then the batting, yeah, I mean, there's a few bats in there who have obviously got a bit of talent, but haven't massively convinced. But I think I think Justin Langer's way is they're going to decide these players and stick with them. There's obviously a lot of love for Travis Head there, who I think will get a proper run. In some ways, selection would be a bit easier if you gave the gloves to Matthew Wade and Payne wasn't in the side. So that could almost kind of free up a spot, make selection a bit easier. And the bowling attack, they were knackered. They had a blip towards the end of this series. But they're still, for me, the most versatile, threatening attack in the world. So there's so many bits that work for Australia. And Smith and Abhishek, they've got two of the very best test bats in the world. There's just those kind of two or three slots and the captain that will become kind of under the spotlight over the next couple of weeks.
One of the things that like genuinely pisses me off about the kind of reaction to Australian cricket and the reaction within Australian cricket is this kind of systematic adjustment of expectations because of the kind of culture evaluation. This kind of, oh, well, the team environment's improved, so we don't have to do as well now. Whereas Australia have literally got, by my own personal opinion, which I will happily take the blows for, the best / second best batsman of all time. They've got an elite batsman in Marnus Labuschagne. They've got one of the best openers of the modern era in David Warner. They've then got their best bowling attack of all time, if you go by that kind of Ben Garden, the metric of the worst, you know, how good is the worst bowler of that attack. And yet they've drawn England against a very, very mediocre side in England. That, you know, that England side was as low as it was going to get for a while. Peyton Roy opening the batting, et cetera, et cetera. They were not good. No James Anderson, et cetera. They needed to win that series. That was their chance. They lost against India 2 years ago. Yeah, they didn't have Warner. You didn't have Smith. That's one thing. But they still had that bowling attack against an Indian batting lineup that was still learning and still kind of developing as a side. They didn't win in the UAE when they went over there. They drew that first game and then lost the second. The markers of Tim Payne's captaincy, the kind of the points where you go, well, those are the pivot points between being okay and being great or being okay and being good. Every single time that's come up, they've gone the other way. They've gone towards being okay. And I think that there does need to be a conversation had about whether or not Tim Payne, not necessarily as a captain himself, but as a kind of institution, is actually underperforming quite substantially. I personally believe he is. I disagree on the idea that he shouldn't be in the side. As much as I don't tend to like specialist keepers who can't really bat, this has been his best ever series with the bat. He's batting really well. He won Australia the test in Adelaide, apart from Josh Hazlewood's fell, but he won it with the bat. He did really well. He kept terribly, but to be honest, there's not really a good alternative. Matthew Wade is in absolute all sorts in form with the bat. I don't think if you give him the gloves, he's going to improve. I think that's probably, if anything, going to take away from already pretty meagre returns. I think what's going to worry them is that they've now lost two home series in 3 years against India. One you could excuse. You can't excuse this one. This one is genuinely, for Australian cricket, if you hold it up as that kind of, you know, the big boys of international cricket, you can't excuse losing to essentially India C. And they've already had the press conference where Payne's come out and said, oh, I'm not going to resign. I'm going to go to South Africa. I'm going to go and be captain. But, and this is the important bit, I don't want to look ahead to the 2021 or the Ashes. I don't want to look that far ahead. And it all felt very much kind of Malcolm Tucker, good resignation, bad resignation. It was like, we're going to try and frame this as like, let's get through to South Africa, beat up a fairly underperforming side there, and then I'll maybe step aside and give the armband to either Travis Head or Pat Cummins. I think Australian cricket is in a worse state than it thinks it is. The last time their openers averaged less, I think, at home was 1988, or maybe even slightly earlier than that. It was when they faced the Windies, and it was like Marshall, Ambrose, Walsh and Patterson. And it's like, I know India are good, they're not that good. It's like Australia have wilted under the pressure of having to perform. And you, by the reaction of the Australian media, you wouldn't know it. And I think that's probably worth having a second look at.
We talked about Cummins and Hazlewood being brilliant. I think they finished the series with averages of 20 and 19 respectively. But Stark and Lyon, particularly towards the end of the series, fed away a little bit. Ben, you wrote about Lyon going into the Gabba test. How do you think he bowled? And do you think, in hindsight, Australia maybe should have looked to rotate their seamers a bit more than they did? Well, anything more than they did.
Well, on the seamer point, I've kind of come round to it. I've had lots of conversations with CricInfo's Dan Brettig over the last 18 months about whether or not Australia were right to do that rotation policy in the 2019 Ashes. At the time, I thought it was kind of silly. I thought you just pick your best attack. It's not the end of the world. You've rested Hazlewood for the entire World Cup, seemingly. You know, let him loose. But actually, it's been kind of vindicated in retrospect in this series because you've looked at it and gone, well, Stark's knackered. Cummins looks knackered, even though he's bowling brilliantly. He's a robot. Hazlewood looks absolutely exhausted. And Lyon's bowled like a brain, as I said earlier. Even someone like a Pattinson, who's a, you know, good bowler, good record, him maybe playing at Melbourne, bringing Michael Nisa, his home ground of the Gabba, might have been quite a useful kind of alternative. I do think they've been slightly hamstrung by how poor Cameron Green's bowling has been. I think it has meant that everyone's bowled maybe 5 overs more, every innings more than they thought. And so, and especially because Lyon's also been hit out of the attack by Pujara and Pant often. I think everything's just been kind of squeezed in a way that they weren't expecting. But I do think, yeah, you can make quite a big case that they needed to rotate more. It's easy point in retrospect, but I do agree with it. Lyon at the SCG bowled too straight, bowled too quick, didn't get enough drift, didn't get enough spin, and he bowled badly. And I think that was obvious. And he bowled slower on day five at the Gabba. He clearly was trying to get more drift. He put more fizz on the ball. He was bowling slightly less over the perpendicular and getting a bit more drift. And I think that did make him look more effective. And the ball that he got Shubman Gill with was the widest ball that he bowled to Gill. And there was a lot of, you know, I get a bit annoyed. And maybe it's just because I do work with Fox. And I get a bit defensive over some of the criticism on Twitter of Shane Warne. Shane Warne knows more about spin bowling than people on Twitter. And he spent all the time that Lyon was bowling saying, why is he bowling this straight line? Why is he bowling this straight line? He needs to bowl the ball wider. He needs to bowl that more attacking line on fifth, sixth stump and turn the ball in. The first ball that he did, he got Shubman Gill and he was kind of fending outside of stump. And I think that was the template for what was going to happen for the rest of the day. And I thought that was going to kind of kickstart Lyon's, you know, quest for 400 wickets and winning the game. It didn't. He just went back to bowling a straight line and he bowled really poorly again. And the fact that he is, you know, all the fanfare, 100th test, all of that, cult status, you know, Gary, the GOAT, et cetera, and he didn't deliver. It's a proper blot on his copybook for me. I think this was a big series for him and he failed. And it's a shame because he's a very good bowler. But Australia, if they did say, you know what, we're going to start again and we're going to pick Swepson or we're going to kind of try and move on and maybe pick two spinners, you'd probably be surprised, but you couldn't say they weren't exactly without kind of evidence for that policy. He bowled badly this series and over a long period of time.
I just want to add, looking at their batting lineup, where's the talent? Where's the real talent coming through? Will Pekoski looked like a quality player, and I know that there are issues around him and he got injured again. But I imagine that he will have a useful test career at least. And Cameron Green with the bat obviously looks like the real deal and his record is terrifying. So there's players coming through. But where's the depth when you have Marcus Harris, who's barely a test match opener, Matthew Wade, who's a reserve keeper batsman, batting at 5 or 6, Travis Head, who's currently not in the team, and is no one's idea of a world-class number five, even if he were to be. Joe Burns stunk the place out. Even David Warner is kind of on the turn. If you look at his record, I mean, okay, at home he's good and he's had a bad series and he may still turn that around. But even so, he's comfortably the wrong side of 30. He's not been the same player since he came back into the team. But you would expect, this is Australian cricket, you would expect there just to be a queue of strapping 2 6-foot-2 beefcakes just round the gabatoir waiting to come in fully ready to go. And yet it doesn't seem from the outside, and this is cyclical, and it needs to be pointed out, and there will be more talent coming through. But as things stand at the moment, there doesn't seem to be that groundswell of options for them, which is, for people of my kind of age who have gone through it forever, that doesn't really add up. You know, I mean, Stuart Law would be their second or third best player in that team, you know, if we were to take back 20 years. So it's interesting. Ben, tell me that I'm wrong.
Wouldn't ever dare do that. What I would say is I don't think there's I think Marcus Harris is a better opener than you're describing. I think that in terms of Shield cricket, him and Pekoski for the Vicks are a genuinely proper opening partnership. And I think that once Warner does go, whether that's before the Ashes, in a year's time, after the Ashes, whatever, that's the next Australian opening partnership. He's not brilliant by any stretch of the imagination, but I think he's in the Warner mould of someone who can strike at 70, 80 when he gets going. And Pekoski's a lot more of a kind of traditional, I play down the ground, I, you know, play at the top of the bounce, I play through the covers as and when there's a bad ball, Australian opener. I think that is, at the very least, a model that they can follow. They play together, they know each other's game, it's left hand, right hand, they've got a bit there. I don't think it's quite as bereft. I think in terms of Travis Head, I think I personally really like Travis Head. During the 2019 Ashes, I was in the Sky commentary box, and at one point Travis Head got out, and a notable Australian commentator kind of walked off and started to basically said he's the loosest player I've ever seen in Test cricket for Australia. It's kind of hard to disagree with that. He plays with such hard hands. He plays so far out in front of his body. But at times in England, he looked really exposed. I think he's good player in Australia. He averages 40 in Test cricket, good batsman.
Averaging 40 in Australia, batting at five on Australian tracks, in the plum position at number five. That's not much to write home about. And then when you see how he's got out, particularly in this series, and away from home, you can write him off completely, but in this series, you know, away from his body, back foot punch shot, and he just keeps getting caught in the gully. This is Australia's number five.
Yeah, you know, it is. He's not, when I say he averages 40, he doesn't average 40 in Australia. He averages 40 full stop. Like, it's not like he's just kind of ticking along at number five, hiding behind everyone else. I don't love him, but I think I can understand why he's there. And, you know, he's a captaincy option if Payne does decide that he's not going to continue scoring runs. The guy who I think, and it might be just personal bias because I've seen him make a lot of runs in person in Australia, and the guy who I think needs to come in is Patterson. He's not had a great season, but I think he's a proper player. The ton that he made against, albeit, you know, in brackets, Sri Lanka at Canberra, was one of the best kind of debut tons that I've seen in Test cricket. He just looks like a player who understands his game. He looks like the kind of clone. It's like if you kind of transplanted Alistair Cook's genes into an Australian cricketer. It's that kind of thing. It's, you know, he's going to make runs in all kinds of conditions. I think there is depth. At the same time, the best young batsman coming through in Australia is Manus Labuschagne. And when he debuted, essentially every single thing on Twitter and in articles about him was about how he had the worst record in first-class cricket of any Australian number three ever. And actually, he's just gone on to kind of spit fire and be a brilliant player. Australian cricket has, you know, for every Zach Crawley that we have, they have 150 Zach Crawleys who average 28 and then rock up at the Gabba and suddenly just know what they're doing and average 40. And I kind of back Australia, and particularly Langer, to unearth those gems. I don't know whether they'll be able to do it to quite the same extent as Labuschagne, but if you can take a guy like that who had a very mediocre record and turn him into potentially the best number three in the world within about 2 years, I'm not too worried about whether or not there's no talent there. It's all very much, you know, give it 2 years and suddenly they've got five batsmen averaging over 45 and yeah, it's English cricket in strife again in Australia. All over us. It's, yeah, hell as old as time.
Anyway, from Brisbane to Gaul, England got their Test winter off to a winning start as they beat Sri Lanka by 7 wickets. There were 5 wicket hauls to Don Best and Jack Leach and a double 100 from Joe Root. But Phil, it'll be rude not to start with Dan Lawrence. He didn't disappoint on debut and assured 73 in the first innings, and he very calmly steered England home alongside Johnny Bairstow in the second off. England had a bit of a wobble early on. How much did you enjoy his performance?
It was all right, wasn't it? Wasn't it nice? Wasn't it joyous? Only trumped by his old man's interview on TMS, which is one of the great bits of radio I've ever heard, I think. Talk about a clash of cultures with Angus coming from one side and Dan Lawrence's old man from Chingford on the other. It was, if you haven't heard it, folks, go out and find it because it is remarkable. I think the second innings was more important than the first, really. Dan Lawrence, everyone knows that he can play spin. Everyone knows that he gets fully forward and fully back and he has those wrists to react to the turning ball. He came out in a dream scenario, really, already up in the innings, comfortably on first innings, and he comes out against a team that is painfully down on its luck, batting with his captain who was strumming it beautifully at the other end. So that is an ideal time to come in. And he played lovely. He played beautifully in the first innings. None of it really surprised me. And I got the sense that it didn't surprise him either. And this is something that's marked him out since he was about 7 years old. Most cricketers, most people in life, they make it up as they go along. And much of it is front and putting on a face. Dan Lawrence has always believed that he's a Test match cricketer ever since he first picked up a bat. And that's what everybody at Essex says. From his academy director, John Childs, who I spoke to about him 3 or 4 years ago, to Tom Wesley, to the rest of them. He might have his own way of doing it, but he has absolute unimpeachable self-belief. And that's what you saw in how smoothly he adapted to the game. But the second innings, that's really thrown England's selection dilemmas out now. And it's going to be very interesting to see what they do, because to make that 20-odd, that low heartbeat 20-odd or even 30-odd, and see England through having been, 11 for 3? 14 for 3, maybe? Suddenly, everyone's around the bat and it's spitting cobras all over the place. for him to have ridden out that scenario, that tells us a hell of a lot. The first innings told us that he can play. The second innings told us that he fancies it. And so he'll obviously play the second test, but then come India. Over to you, Joe, really. I mean, how do they get seven or eight batsmen into that top six? How do they do it?
We've been asking each other that for the latest issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly, ready to make complete fools of ourselves by printing this before the second test in Sri Lanka. I think I completely agree. I thought Lawrence batted beautifully in the first innings, but it was the second innings that made me think he's got to play in India. Particularly day five, which was still a bit of a tricky chase. But I thought Bairstow kind of led that bit on day five. He was the man in control. But day four, end of day four, was a completely different scenario. Bairstow had run out route, very nearly ran himself out the very next ball. If he'd done that, England would seriously in problems at that stage. And it was Lawrence at that point. Bairstow still very frenetic. It was Lawrence that was really cool, grinning from ear to ear, absolutely loving it. And if you can do it in that situation, fair enough, it's not packed full of people. But in terms of the match context, if you can do it there on that pitch, which was starting to turn sharply, Embledenya had bowled brilliantly in the first innings, but actually the Pereira started bowled quite nicely in the second innings as well, suddenly looking a bit more threatening. That match was suddenly right on a knife edge, which might not look like that now when you look back on the scorecard, but it absolutely was, particularly with Sam Curran at seven, the longest tail that England have had in a long time with Wood, Broad and Leach. And the game was on, and Lawrence was the one that brought it back under control. And there's really no kind of more impressive thing a youngster can do on debut than come through in that pressurised situation.
We'll go into a bit more detail on how we think the top seven should look for India on next week's show. But Joe, what was your moment of the week?
So mine came shortly before tea on day one in Gaul, in the midst of that kind of dire first innings batting display from Sri Lanka. And it was Jack Leach's first test wicket for 14 months. Fairly innocuous delivery, as most of them that took wickets were. Chandamal caught a cover, a good catch from Sam Curran. But it's important to put that wicket and actually Leach's overall performance in the match in context, because he's had a horrendous run of injury, sickness, hospitalised with sepsis, got that mystery bug in South Africa, and the fact he's got Crohn's disease, which makes him particularly vulnerable to COVID. And then when he finally is fit, he spends the summer watching his understudy at Somerset become England's first choice spinner, and he barely bowled. I think I wrote this down. So in fact, last year, he bowled 52 overs across the whole of 2020. He bowled 59 alone in the first test at Gaul, which he said himself, he didn't bowl brilliantly. He can obviously bowl much better than that. But to toil away in the second innings where he went for a few, he's bowling too short at times, but to come back and get that 5-wicket haul in its own way was quite an exceptional performance, really. And a kind of a welcome reminder of just what Leach can bring to this side. And it's worth looking at his overall record. It's a small sample size, but 11 tests, taken 40 wickets at 29, strike rate of 61. That's a better average and strike rate than Swan, better than Panesar, better than Rashid, considerably better average than Moeen. As I say, it is a small sample size, and it's early days. India will be a huge test for him. But I do think he's currently England's best red ball spinner by some distance. And perhaps this kind of cult hero status that he enjoys with the famous one not out and the wiping of the specs has kind of overshadowed his bowling in some ways. A little bit like we saw with Monty, who certainly among casual fans would know him for his awful batting, awful fielding, and sometimes just what a brilliant bowler on his day he was would be forgotten. I think Leach isn't as naturally talented as Monty, but he's cannier, and I think he has got quite a lot to offer this England side. I think he's a good spinner who now deserves a decent run in the side.
I think on Leach, I think you were right to bring up kind of his cult status in the Ashes, because I think it detracted from him actually having quite a good Ashes with the ball. He averaged like 28, 29 in a home Ashes series, took four on the last day at the Oval. I think a lot was made of his performance in the first New Zealand test last year where New Zealand ended up scoring 615 and Watling got a double 100, about him not being particularly threatening on what was essentially a dead pitch. But I don't think any other English spinner that England have at the moment would have done much better than he did in those conditions. I thought what was really encouraging was how he did get better as the test went on. He managed to get more good balls in a row put more pressure on the Sri Lankans, and also bowled really, really good wicket-taking deliveries as well. I think four of his five wickets were like your classical left-arm spinner around the wicket, turning away from a right-hander, either beating the edge or getting the edge. So yeah, I thought it was a pretty encouraging performance for Leach.
I was just going to say, it kind of reminded me, just kind of when Joe was mentioning about his amazing record, it's a bit of the kind of Stuart McGill thing where like McGill has a better record than Warne, because whenever McGill played, it was on an absolute ragger. And so, Leach does tend to play more Test cricket in helpful conditions. But at the same time, I think what we've seen now is over, as you say, with the addition of the 2019 Ashes as a bit of a kind of test of what you can do in other situations. I don't think anyone actually thinks Don Best is a better bowler than Jack Leach. And I know that's quite a trite thing to say, but I don't think anyone actually does think it. Jack Leach is a better test match bowler than Don Best. And there was a really nice piece by Johnny Lewis in The Guardian about how, you know, Don Best has kind of overcome a lot of personal issues, and he's clearly a really impressive young lad and genuinely a nice fella to just kind of have around the camp. You can see his value. But you look at how India have constructed their side over the last few years. The one thing they've been criticised for is having a long tail that doesn't bat. Now, Jack Leach fits far more into that mould than Don Best. He's much more a bowler who doesn't bat. I know he's obviously had famous exploits with the bat, but having a spinner who is primarily a spinner is the most important thing if you do want to go to India and win. I think that in terms of our one measure on Twitter that's done quite well this week, it was expected wickets, and we did the rounds that Don Best's 5-for in the first innings was essentially the least deserving 5-for. According to the deliveries he bowled that we've ever recorded since 2006 by an English spinner. And so I think, if anything, that just underlines the fact that Don Best is a good bowler. It's fine. Jack Leach is a really good bowler and should be backed above Best. And if England can construct the rest of their side well, I'm not on the show next week, so this is my throwing my few pennies worth in for the India discussion. If England construct the rest of their side well, then Leach has to play. India, as far as I'm concerned.
The wicket of Dick Weller in particular was just awful cricket, wasn't it? This embarrassment.
It was a horrible day of Test cricket. I saw that Michael Vaughan got absolute pelters on Twitter for saying that this was a bad advertisement for Test cricket, which, as well as being that kind of hyper-real thing of a thing being an advert for itself, you know, it was a bad day of Test cricket. England bowled terribly, Sri Lanka bowled terribly. That was it, really. It was a bit of a shame. England did not deserve to take the wickets that they did. But hopefully England can take the lessons from that and kind of move forward with a degree of expectation. They don't think they're going to do that to India first day in the Test series.
We've not actually mentioned Joe Root yet. The skipper got an enormous year for him and himself and the team off to the perfect start by scoring 228. Phil, how impressed were you by Root? Personally, I thought that was the best he's batted for at least 2 years, or the most fluently he's looked for at least 2 years. And I thought after the game as well, he talked about rediscovering some of his rhythm and also the benefits of just having some time off, which he just hasn't had for years.
Four double hundreds now, 8,000 test runs, 98 tests, and he's just turned 30. Last month, got a bottle of Wisden whiskey, as it goes, sent through, number 66. He is, bizarre as it sounds, he's quite an underrated cricketer, really, I think, Joe Root. We take him for granted, and we get invariably uptight because, you know, he makes a 50 basically every other time he walks out to bat in Test cricket, which is insane. But then he has the temerity not to then convert that into match-winning hundreds time after time after time. And we dwell on that point. Well, I think we should dwell on the first bit. I think we should dwell on the ridiculous consistency of the kid. And also, I think your boss, Nathan, Ben, has kind of crunched the numbers on the value of 100 and then, you know, three single-digit scores versus 450s. And I think, and I mean, probably common sense would imply this as well, but I think Nathan's kind of proved it through maths that the player that is consistently there, consistently impacting an innings, is the player that you want. And Joe continues to do that time after time. What he does also have that is often unremarked upon is this this depth of grit and toughness. Because he's quite softly spoken and, you know, pretty and demonstrably lovely, people forget about this a little bit, I think, with Root. But he is as tough as they come. And he knows that his legacy is in his hands over the next 12, 18 months. It's become a cliche, isn't it? It's become a cliche. England's big year and Joe's big year. But he knows it. And when I interviewed him when he was in South Africa a couple of months ago, he's absolutely conscious of it. He said he treated the enforced sabbatical of the pandemic as a time to reset. You know, now this is a player who's played two formats, would like to play three, but he's played two formats for 10 years and more. He's got a young kid and a young family, and finally he had a moment to breathe last summer. That's a terrible phrase to use, isn't it? You know what I'm getting at. And he emerged ready to go again, I think. His position as the leader of the team is probably more unimpeachable now than it's probably ever been before. I think he acknowledges that he didn't take to the job naturally. He's not Henry V. He's not a great orator, particularly. He's a celestially gifted batsman who was the right man to take over from Cook. I wrote last month. I think he will be remembered in the end as a batsman, but he has the chance to be remembered as a captain batsman, and that's what he's striving for. That's what he's aiming for. And look, what a great start! And just very, very briefly, I know Ben wants to come in. Sorry. And Ben can back me up here, or tell me that I'm talking nonsense. I think against the turning ball throughout his career, his record is astonishing, and he is a master, a true, true master of playing the turning ball.
Yeah, he's absolutely gone. I mean, we all know that. I think since 2000, which is kind of the point from which we greatest have kind of complete ball-by-ball data, the only England batsman who averages more against spin is Graham Thorpe, who was a bit before my time, but from what I can tell from the sepia-tinged kind of video footage, was apparently quite good. So I think that's kind of testament to the fact that, you know, Joe Root has overcome everything, all those great players who played in the kind of late 2000s into the early 2010s, Biggie Peterson, your Cooks, your Trotts, and he's better than them against spin. And he's playing against, you know, often in tougher conditions. Some of these pitches that we've seen in Sri Lanka over the last few years have been, you know, they've been proper raggers, they've been properly difficult. And he just deals with it. He gets fully forward, gets fully back. He's just a proper player of spin. Two stories about people who I know who are better at what I do than me. One of them, as you say, about Nathan, he's written a very fascinating book, including more analysis of the idea of whether you want to be consistent at the top of the order, make big runs or make consistent runs, called Hitting Against the Spin. He'll be hitting the shelves in the next few months. It's co-authored by me. Awkward, but it is there. The other one is Patrick Noon of CricViz. Jogged my memory and kind of stirred the emotions a little bit when he was talking about this week Wayne Rooney retired. And, you know, obviously the kind of great white hope of English football at the start of, you know, the early 2000s, heralded as going to be the greatest English footballer of all time, and then kind of was. But no one really cared by the end. It kind of petered out, and he was world class for a year and a half, and then was just very, very good for an awfully long time. Broke all the records, broke the records for United, broke the records for England in terms of goal scoring. But people just kind of go, well, yeah, well, he doesn't quite do enough, does he? He doesn't quite kick on enough. Doesn't quite do this. But actually, it's kind of comparable to Joe Root. Joe Root arrives and is told that he's going to be the great batting talent of his generation. Is just rocks up, you know, as you say, 8,000 test runs, is basically brilliant. He, for all of Stokes, is genius. Just because Root doesn't have that kind of nail that he can hang his hat on in terms of the innings, Root's a better batsman than Stokes. Root's inconsistent more than Stokes. He's been more inconsistent more than anyone in the world for England, really. The fact that he doesn't have that kind of one moment to kind of centre his career around is the one failing against him. But I just thought the comparison between them was quite apt in terms of these are guys who were, from basically 18 years old, told they're going to be the best player that their country has ever produced. And they have delivered on that talent. They've just not delivered on it in the way that a sporting culture, which demands kind of mercurial unsung heroes who come from nowhere to be Roy the Rovers and kind of be amazing. That sporting culture doesn't really value consistently very, very good performance. Doesn't really know how to understand it and to reward it. And I think, Rooney will go down as England's best ever footballer. Whether Root does is probably dependent on the next year. I hate to be cliche, but it probably does. And if he can have one big innings, whether it's, double ton at the Gabba or, Boxing Day, double century, then that's one thing. But hopefully English cricket is kind of maturing to the point where it can understand that, not everyone can be Stokes. Some people have to be the kind of laying the groundwork that Stokes jumps off. He's great. He's a brilliant batsman, and I think he is underrated. And you do get criticism for saying that. But out of the Fab Four, every other country in the world, whether it's India supporting Kohli, Australia supporting Smith, or New Zealand supporting Williamson, are going to bat for him, whereas England don't really love Root in the same way that those countries love their batsmen. And that's a bad thing, but I think it does separate him from that group.
No, I made a similar comparison in a piece I wrote for Wisden.com this week about how in British sport, we kind of overhype young players and then underappreciate them when they don't quite meet those enormous expectations. So not just Rooney, but Rory McIlroy is another one. So Rory McIlroy won as many majors in golf by the age of 25 as any person from the UK since the war. And for the 6 years since has been consistently in the top 10, but no one really thinks of him as like this all-time British sporting great. And I think with Root, it's almost like people not being satisfied with him being the fourth best player of his generation because he's not quite, why doesn't he quite do what Williamson, Smith and Kohli do? But from an English point of view, I think what is really exciting is that peak Root and peak Stokes have never really played that much together at the same time. Stokes' best 2 years as a Test cricketer have come as Root has had his mini slump where he's not quite hit the levels he hit in 2014, 15, 16. So that's very exciting. Joe, question for you. It's only one test, but are you at all concerned by how England's openers have fared against Sri Lanka's spinners? I think Dom Sibley in particular hasn't done great in test cricket, even going back to his debut in New Zealand against bowlers who've turned the ball away from him. I think his game against pace is based on really good judgment of where his off stump is and knowing when to leave the ball and when not to. And against left arm spinners and right arm leg spinners, I think he struggles a little bit. How concerned do you think England should be about that?
I think from the dismissals in the first test, I think Sibley is more of a concern than Crawley, particularly in the first innings. I thought Crawley, just if it actually played that shot with a bit more conviction, I don't think it was a bad shot to play. Whereas Sibley looks a bit confused, looks a bit stuck on the crease. I think it is this issue. I think Sibley's not a natural player of spin. He won't have faced a huge amount of quality spin bowling in county cricket. And it's a really hard place to learn. And particularly when you haven't got warm-up games against local opposition, if you're just playing amongst yourselves, it's no preparation to play the type of spinners that you then have to face in the Test series. I think it's going to be quite a tough winter for Sibley, and that's not to say that he can't ever work out a game against spin. I mean, when I spoke to him, he's clearly a very thoughtful cricketer. He's had difficulties in the past that he's overcome. But I do think it's a lot to ask him to get from the stage he is now to be able to take on Jadeja and Ashwin in a month or so and actually do the job that he's in the side for. So look, he gets the second test in Sri Lanka, obviously, but I would consider not picking him for that first test in India if he doesn't get scored in the second test. And that's no reflection on what he's done as an opener so far for England. I think he's done exactly the job he was picked for. Come the first test of an English summer, he's right back in there. But I do fear that currently he hasn't got the game to do what he needs to against the Indian spinners. Crawley's another interesting one. I mean, we assume he's such an adaptable, natural batsman. We assume that this will just be the next challenge that he kind of excels in. But he has still basically played one, admittedly, stupendously brilliant innings. But he hasn't got a kind of a real back catalogue of great knocks behind him. So he has also got a difficult task ahead of him. But I do have less concerns. I think Sibley is the one. And then you come to the point of India. Do you start thinking, I know we're going to do this next week, but do you start thinking makeshift opener territory? Do you put someone like Bairstow or Pope up top because you just play the players who are best equipped to play the conditions? Or do you stick with your traditional openers? And I think that's a question England are going to have to think about ahead of India.
Phil, any other changes that you'd make from the England side?
Probably Anderson for Broad. No reflection on Broad. He doesn't have to get uptight or upset. But, you know, they're coming thick and fast. You've got four tests in India back to back pretty much. I'd bring Anderson in for the second test. I felt sorry for Mark Wood. Went wicketless, I think, across both innings. Looked unusually down in the dumps towards the back end of the second innings. Maybe bring Wokes in for him, possibly. The rotation of the quicks out there makes a lot of sense to me. I would like to see Moeen Ali get in the team somehow. I think we are being too careless with this cricketer. If they're serious about taking 20 Indian wickets twice in four test matches, I mean, you know, we've probably got two hopes on that one, but we should see. But if they're serious about it, then you need a spinner who's going to properly rag it, going to go at 5.5 and over, and going to take 3 for 120 in 25 overs. That kind of spell, those kinds of figures are gold dust in India. So I would like to see him in, almost whisper it, and it sounds terrible, this is a test match, almost as a bit of a trial game, you know, a bit of a trial game. Get him in there somewhere. I don't think they need necessarily three seamers, one of whom is Sam Curran, necessarily. Or they could drop Wood and bring in Mo for Wood. So, you know, there's different options available to them. But I think it would be a bit of a misstep to go into that India series without having had a look at Moeen to see where he's at with the red ball. And even if it takes him an innings and a bit to get going, and then he has a bit of a say towards the back end of the game, and as the rustiness starts to go, then that's something that I would seriously look at. As for the batsman, obviously you keep the top six as it stands, with all the caveats around the opening bats. What Joe was just saying, just there, just very briefly, it reminded me of what Simon Armour said to me a year or two ago about English batsmen. He said, with the exception of James Vince, shut up, Ben, let it go. With the exception of James Vince, English batsman, this is what Harmer said to me, it's four or it's a block. It's a four or it's a block. It's a risk shot or it's a block. And he said, in the end, I'm going to get you. And Dom Sibley, who's a fine player against the seamers and definitely has a future, I think, as an England opener. But I worry that approach... Or rather, I worry about what's required against the turning ball in those conditions is not really his game, and that he will be a sitting duck in the end. Crawley is there's a higher ceiling, necessarily so, but again, he has a similar kind of approach as well. You know, he was brought up playing seamers, and he plays the seamers beautifully. He'd have to learn how to play against the turning ball as well. Lawrence is a more natural player. Pope is quite a natural player of the turning ball, and Root is obviously a gifted natural player. But it doesn't come easily to English players, you know, grooved as they are in English conditions.
You might have seen on the coverage on TV and on the radio, actually, that England did have one fan in Sri Lanka, Rob Lewis, a 37-year-old web designer from Surrey, flew out to Sri Lanka in March and never left in the hope that England would return there. I spoke to him early this morning about his weird and wonderful journey that led him to being England's sole fan in Sri Lanka, and his quite interesting journey into being allowed to watch the game in the end as well.
So first up, what possessed you to stay in Sri Lanka after the first tour was cancelled back in March?
So I got here and I already knew that the game was cancelled as I was sat on the plane waiting to take off when the news came, but it was one of the last sporting events to be cancelled, actually. So it was inevitable. So there was a week here in Unawatuna Beach where the Barmy Army and cricket fans kind of congregated. And then the news kind of deteriorated. People panicked and got flights home. The foreign minister is telling all Brits abroad to come home. But I'd actually been working pretty solid to afford this trip. It was actually my second flight I bought out there, as the original ones were cancelled. So I wasn't going to give this up so easily. So I stayed. I mean, a huge factor in that is I work remotely and I have my laptop with me. So obviously that played a big part that I could do that. I just thought I thought Corona would be over in a month. I think most people did think that as well. So it went into kind of lockdown here. And then England's return was penciled in quite early for January 21, so I kind of formed the idea it would be pretty hilarious if I stayed this whole time. And I can't actually believe it's been as long as that, and it's happened. Yeah.
What's it been like staying in another country during a pandemic?
Well, I mean, it's not been difficult at all. The first 2 months was hard because Colombo was strictly locked down. People couldn't leave their houses. I was actually in the south, so I had it a bit easier. But they had 3 or 6 day curfews where you couldn't leave the property. But then they'd have a day off or 2 days off so people can go to the shop and get food. So that went on for 2 months. I was staying in a hostel with one other person. The hostel was closed, so they let us stay in, but we had to sort of cook and fend for ourselves. But that, at the same time, I adopted a little pup. We'd had a bit of a hard upbringing, so he was staying in my room. So it was nice to have a little bit of company, his little mate that was just following me around. And it wasn't, I mean, I was on the beach, so I kept sneaking onto the beach. I'd have this whole, I was in Hiracatia. Normally it's like thriving for the tourists. And I had it on like to myself for many, many times. It was very surreal. So that was, it wasn't too bad. And then, I mean, comparing myself to other people, say back home in the UK, that may have been living in like flats or small apartments, I generally had it very good. So it wasn't too hard at all, to be perfectly honest with you.
Were there any moments where you potentially regretted your decision? I'm just thinking particularly when England's tour to South Africa got cancelled halfway through it, or when Moeen got his positive COVID test. Were you worried that after all these months that it might be cancelled at the last minute?
Yeah, there was plenty of red flag moments. I mean, it was a wing and a prayer that they were going to come back. It only got confirmed in early December. So, I mean, what's that like? 7 months when I wasn't even sure they were coming back. But I missed family and friends, but I don't think there was any point when I thought I was gonna come home. I was having a pretty good time. I kind of enjoyed traveling. I was getting work done. I was able to support myself. So even if England didn't come, it wasn't like it would have all been not worth it. Like I've been having a good time out here.
Nice. And then I saw on Twitter that there was a bit of drama getting to the venue. So what happened there, and how were you eventually allowed to watch the test from the fort?
Communication is not Sri Lanka's strong point. There were rumours, up to this point, I was imagining being able to get in. The Barmy Army said they should be able to get me in. Michael Vaughan made a false promise he would be able to get me in. I've been joking with Mickey Arthur the whole time that I could be the Sri Lankan water boy to get in. What I didn't know was that the game was behind closed doors, but that was meant very strictly, like you couldn't get near the ground. The fort was always my fallback. I got there nice and early on day one. I spent 2 hours putting up 3 banners. They're 5 metres by 3 metres. So I had a help from my friend Tom. So we put those up. I sang Jerusalem as loud as I could. Probably not quite in the right key. I didn't try my best trying to project my voice from the fort on my own. But after that, it just descended into huge disappointment. They kicked me off. They took my banners down. That was heartbreaking. then I had to go to the police station to try and get permission to be on the fort. So I was there twice. To get sent in circles. I was at gates around the ground trying to peer through the fence, and then kept getting moved on by like men with guns. I kept trying to sneak on the fort, but the police just had me as a marked man. I eventually took matters into my own hands and put high-vis and hard hat on and dressed up as a construction worker, because there were workers up there, to try and get a vantage point for the game. I eventually got caught by the police. They were like, "Sir, why are you wearing this?" I said I'm on the work site, it's safety first. So that humoured them, and they said, you really want to watch the game? And I was like, yeah, I do. So they let me watch the evening session of the first day from the fort, which was nice of them. However, day two I returned, and this angered them a lot. They said they'd given me a chance to watch last night, and now you've come back. You're taking the mick out of us. They're like, just leave and don't come back. you're not allowed. So it's pretty hard and fast. So at that point, I was like, oh no, this is only day two, and this is not going to happen. So I tried the ground again, peered through fences. I resigned to watch it in a cafe with other fans that are trying to get in. And that's when, I've been talking to reporters and people back home quite a bit. And one reporter gave me a number for someone at the SLC. So I rang this dude up and said, I need to get on the media accreditation lift to give me access to the fort to be able to report on the game. And they needed permission from the England camp. And I needed permission from Danny Rubin. So I messaged Danny Rubin and he offered to help straight away. He replied back saying yes. He sent an email to the man at the SLC saying I have permission. So after that, the guy from the SLC said he'd phoned the police and told them I was allowed. And as I went back up to the fort at the end of day two, the same policeman that had been kicking me off and telling me not to come back, they were like, ah, Mr. Lewis, welcome. Their attitude was a complete reversal. So I saw the end of play on day two there. And from that point on, it was just amazing. I was one of only like two people up there the whole game. There was another reporter up there. But I was able to sing Jerusalem on day three, which was amazing. And I caught Joe Root's 100, where he saluted me. So it's nice of him to double up because I missed his century because I couldn't get in the ground. So it's very nice of him to double up and give me a chance to clap him.
That's amazing. What was it like to watch a whole test match essentially by yourself?
Very surreal. I'd imagined being the only England fan singing Jerusalem. I played this out over in my head quite a few times. But there could have, I mean, if they'd let people up on the fort, there would have been a few other people up there. But I never, it actually like materialised. It was so surreal. Like, I'm trying to sing songs. I don't even know if they can hear me or not. Just yelling as loud as I can. Got told off for hanging more banners off the side twice. I was on my last, last warning. They're like, don't hang the banners off, sir. I was like, okay, I've really apologise. But it was incredible. I think I've proven, on one hand, I think I've proven a point that we need the fans back because it can't be left for one man to sing these songs. My throat is pretty coarse after a few days of that.
And Joe Root not only saluted you when he got to 100, but he gave you a call as well. That was pretty special. Did you know that was going to happen?
No, entirely unexpected. He gave me a clap after the game from the far side, which was great, and I got caught on camera, so that was a special moment. And I just kind of hang around on the fort. I was just lapping up the moment, had a couple of beers to celebrate the win. And then he came over with Danny. I could see he was on the phone. It turns out he was on the phone to TMS, telling them that he's about to call me. And then he just waved, like, with a little phone signal. So I looked at my phone, he's calling me, and had a personal call from the England captain. It was, oh, man. It was amazing. It was just remarkable. Remarkable. It was.
What did he say to you?
He was thanking me for my support. He'd heard of my story. Said the lads appreciated it. I was just thanking him back, just saying thank you and well done on your Man of the Match awards. It means the world. I was like, you made me a very happy boy. It was an amazing gesture.
What's next then? Are you going to stay in Sri Lanka for good, follow England around the world, get a gig with the Barmy Army? What's next?
Well, the immediate future is the second test, which starts on Friday. So I'll be here singing loud and proud on my own. So I'm going to just revel in it because this is never going to happen again. This is insane. So I'm going to do that. I'm hoping to get in the ground. There's rumours they're going to let some media in, and whether that includes me still being on this list, I don't know. So fingers crossed for that. I've been chatting to the Barmy Army this whole time. They have been super amazing. I've set up this charity campaign for We Care, who look after the street dogs. I asked the Barmy Army if you want me to like hang your flags and sing your songs and represent them, then please can you help me support this charity, which they have done. Chris Millard and the team have been truly amazing with that. I can't thank them enough. So we've been chatting. I said there's quite a lot going on, Chris. Obviously, your attention is going to turn to the India tour. That is also meant to be behind closed doors. I don't know. I don't know. It would be great if I could get a gig with the Barmy Army. They've mentioned it already. So reporting for them would be a dream. We'll talk after the second test and see what happens.
Away from those two test matches, Pakistan have announced a test squad for their home series against South Africa that gets underway very soon. They've dropped Mohammed Abbas, Harris Sahail and Sean Massoud. And they've included 9 uncapped players in a squad of 20 that includes Harris Routh, who's only played 3 first-class games, and Tavish Khan, a 36-year-old seamer. So that should be interesting. They also dropped Zafar Gohar, who made his debut in Pakistan's most recent test. And finally, Phil, what is your moment of the week?
I thought you'd never ask. I interviewed Mithali Raj yesterday, and it was one of the most beautiful interviews I've ever had the privilege to be a part of. It will appear in the next magazine, which goes to print tomorrow. Joe, we better get off this podcast.
We really should.
It's well overrun anyway. That's what happens when you get Jones on it.
Sorry, just to say, you can genuinely see the fear in these two guys' eyes at the fact that we've been going for an hour and a half. And I'm still trying to jump in to say something about Harris Routh. There's like a deep fear there.
Well, you'll have to let Harris Routh slide, I'm afraid. Just on Mithali, obviously, you know, the legend of Indian women's cricket averages 50, north of 50 in both ODIs and test matches. She's still going as the ODI captain, 38 years young, been playing for 2 decades, straddled the various eras of Indian women's cricket from the days where it was disdained upon, and that was a generous way of putting it, to now. And I've rarely spoke to a cricketer who is as articulate, engaged, interesting, funny, and all round good value, really. So yeah, that was quite a stirring occasion to speak to her. And it's not often that you get to speak to Indian cricketers, especially over here in England. We had 45 minutes. We went round the houses, and it was quite a beautiful interview, really. So that'll appear in the next magazine. Go out and buy it, please. Please.
That comes out next week, next Thursday, am I right?
Next Thursday. You can pre-order it on the internet.
Excellent. That's all for today's quite long show. Thanks, Ben, Phil, Joe. Thanks, listeners, if you've managed to get this far. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends, and we'll be back next week. Cheers.
And next week's Harry Kane.
Podcast Network.